Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Her Story Circle podcast. This is Gertrude Mache here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. Welcome to the only podcast that is dedicated to bringing you inspirational stories from women from all over the world. Our stories range from business and entrepreneurship, health and wellness, family and relationships, creativity, spirituality, and social justice. All these phenomenal women have one thing in common. We believe that we can change the world one story at a time, one woman at a time, by honoring our stories and our personal experiences, and sharing our successes and failures, and transmuting our trials and tribulations in life into learnings and the stepping stones to our future success. Our vision is to inspire, uplift, empower, collaborate, and impart the knowledge that we have gained through our personal experiences.
Can you remember a time when you had to make a decision and stand up for what you believed in? It was September 1978, I was 15. Came home after completing my probationary period for my aircraft engineer's apprenticeship. The first time in my life I felt optimistic and hopeful that my future might be okay. That was when I had to make a decision and stand up for what I believed in. I'll come back to that shortly, but first my story. My story started way back in 1930. In the 30s in Italy, if you fell pregnant out of wedlock, the community backlash was awful. The shame, embarrassment, and humiliation the community projected is something you carried with you for a long time. My grandmother fell pregnant out of wedlock. That's how my father came to be. He was born in July 1930. My grandmother blamed my father for the shame, embarrassment, and humiliation she felt from the community, and made sure my father never forgot that feeling. When my father was 22 years old, he said to his mum, "I'm going to Belgium to work in the mines. I'll send all my money back to you. Use half the money for yourself and the family, the other half saved for me for my return." 3 years later, in 1955, he returns and asks for his money. His mum responds by saying, "How dare you even think you can ask? An embarrassment to this family. I wish I never had had you. There is no money." How do you respond to that? My father was devastated, heartbroken. Out of anger, he bought a one-way ticket to Australia. Meanwhile, in the other side of the country, Maria, my mum, was living in Sicily. She experienced abuse from her father and grandfather. It was common for immigrants to want to meet ladies from their home country. Maria heard of this and found my father through a dating agency and started writing to him. 2.5 years later, Maria buys a one-way ticket to travel to a country she'd never been to marry a man she'd never met. Now that's what I call courage. Maria arrives in Melbourne on Boxing Day 1960. Her first night in the land of opportunity, the lucky country, Maria rolls over and cries herself to sleep. The next day, Maria insists that they marry as they had sex out of wedlock. The following year, they have their first child, a boy. My father was a jealous, possessive man. He would control Maria and move any time she made a friend. We moved 13 times in the next 13 years. Maria found this difficult. By now, depression is setting in. She cannot bear the loneliness of having no friends and moving all the time. My mum pleads with my father and said, "I've come here to make a life with you. I want to spend some time with you. Please spend one day per week with me. I can't stand the loneliness." My father worked 7 days per week on the farm. He became angry at my mum and said, "I'm working hard for the family. Why do you not appreciate what I do for us?" How much pain must a woman be in to be 7 months pregnant with her second child and decide to take her own life. As Mare removed the last corrugated sheet covering the well, she goes to jump into the well as my father grabbed her by the hair, threw her to the ground. Feeling powerless, my mum turned her focus towards the pregnancy. She had hoped for a baby girl. She hoped having a girl would bring her some joy and happiness. 4:07 p.m. on the 9th of February, 1963, Maria was disappointed in giving birth to a baby boy. That boy was me. My mum's wish for a baby girl happened on the 15th of May, 1966. She gave birth to a healthy, beautiful baby girl, Anna Maria, my sister. In the 60s, it was common for mothers to prop up a bottle with a pillow while feeding a baby and leave the room. On the 2nd of August, 1966, she did just that. She had Anna Maria her bottle, propped it up with a pillow and left the room. When she came back, Anna Maria was choking on the milk. Mum became frantic, calling out for my dad. By the time the ambulance got Anna Maria to the hospital, some 45 minutes away, Anna Maria had choked and died. She overheard the doctor saying they will need an autopsy. As she couldn't speak English, she thought the doctors were blaming her. Can you imagine the pain my mum must have been in? Losing her baby girl, feeling responsible for her death, feeling isolated with no friends, and living with a controlling, abusive man. 6 months later, just after my 4th birthday, I was home alone with my mum. Couldn't find her anywhere. I searched for her. Mama, mama. She did not respond. I found her on the bedroom floor, unconscious, with an empty pill bottle beside her. I pushed poor mama wake up. Scared, I did not know what to do. Exhausted, I fell asleep on my mum. My dad found us when he came home from work that day. Called an ambulance and they got her to the hospital where they pumped her stomach. To kill yourself in that time, they called you mad. My mum had lost her voice to my father and the system. They locked her up in Mayday Hills Mental Institution. As I was leaving Mayday Hills, I remember looking at my mum through a 12 by 12 inch glass window. I remember feeling her pain, her despair. She just wanted someone to love her and wanted to come home with us. I knew then as a four-year-old that they locked up the wrong person. By the next year, my mum was on psychiatric medication and both her and my dad were alcoholics. They went into detox and I got to stay at the O'Briens. I can remember Mrs. O'Brien. I could still smell the mothballs in the room I slept in. She was very kind. She felt my fear of not knowing. She gets down on one knee and asks me what I want to do for the day. She asked me, how cool was that? No one had ever asked me before. She took me bareback horse riding. It was so much fun. For one day, Mrs. O'Brien made me feel like a king, like I belonged. She was kind, gentle, and loving. Once we returned home, we found all our furniture removed from the house and stored in the garage. As I was the smallest child, my father put me through the window so I can unlock the doors. Not long after three men pull up, I could see my father was angry as he confronted the men. A fight broke out, was no match for the men. They beat him up badly. My mother then pulls a knife from the front of her dress and went the men. They knocked her out cold with one punch to the face. I had to do something, so I grab an axe and I go to fight the three men. One of the men grabbed me by the head and said, "Son, our fight's not with you." We were evicted. Mrs. O'Brien allowed us to sleep in her dairy until we found suitable housing. It was hard, my father keeping my mum isolated, not allowing her any support. I became her support person. This made school very difficult. I'd go to school for a day, then miss 2 days. One of the kids would help me to catch up, then I missed 2 more days. They would help me again. For the third time I missed 2 or 3 days of school, they wouldn't want to help me. New kid would jump in enthusiastically. The same thing would happen until they realised I missed so much schooling. I think I missed about 60% of my schooling to stay home and care for my mum. By now, my mum was losing her mind and started hearing voices. I'm now 6 years old and my mum frantically asked me to help her. "Eugene, help me, pray with me. We're all going to die. The world is going to end. Please pray with me." My mum believed that we're all going to die by drowning. I couldn't swim, you see. I was so scared I could not show my mum how scared I was, as she was more scared than me. So I get down on my knees, terrified, and pray with her. This went on month after month after month. My mum was in and out of Mayday Hills Mental Institution. On this day, I'm visiting my mum at Mayday Hills. I'm now 12 years old. They asked me if I could interpret for my mum. After some basic questions about health and general well-being, I'm asked to ask my mum if there was anything she would like us to know. I asked my mum and she said, yes, there is. Can you please tell the nurse that I like my husband to stop raping me? I don't like it. The nurse said, is there anything else? My mum said, no. The nurse said, see you next time. The sad truth was what my mum said was true. My dad would wake me up in the middle of the night to get him wine. This would happen until my mum was so drunk she couldn't resist him. Then he would do whatever he wanted to her, if I was in the room or not. It messes with your mind when you know what is happening is wrong, but the mental health system did nothing. So what are you meant to think when you're 12? It really fucks with your mind and your sexuality. Fast forward to the spring of 1978. I'm now 15 years old. This was the day I felt optimistic and hopeful about my future, passing my probationary period for my apprenticeship. As I entered my backyard, I could hear my mum and dad fighting. My father pushed my mum off a set of stairs. She lands on the concrete path behind her. That was it. I was finally old enough. I couldn't let this happen anymore. Grandma's father threw him up against the wall and said, that is the last time you'll ever hurt my mother. Moments later, comes out holding a 12-inch knife. I remember looking at my dad and believing that he would stop, that he would not hurt me. Have you ever felt that level of certainty? So I stood there. Before I could take my next breath, he strikes the knife at my heart, cutting my chest as I fall to the ground. He strikes again and again. He wanted me dead. As I look up at my father, my mind could not comprehend what was happening. My certainty turned to fear, then terror. I thought I was about to die at the hands of my father. You know how worthless you are when your own father wants to kill you. I somehow managed to get away and get the police. 8 to 10 years jail for attempted murder, they said. The police handcuffed my father to the bed. My mum led me to the other room and said, Eugene, you will not charge Dad with attempted murder. My sole purpose since I was 4 was to care for my mum. I was never more lost than in that moment. My inner star stopped shining that day. I don't know what took more of my life. My dad trying to kill me, my mum supporting him, or the police and the system doing nothing. That day I took on the belief that if I stand up for what I believe in, I will die, that I'm not worthy of being supported, they'll be abandoned no matter what I do. Fast forward to 2020. I'm fired from my executive role, have an argument with my son, so I decide to leave my home. I get a phone call saying, this is on me, I need to fix it. I felt I couldn't go home. I was so lost I did not know what to do. I lost my mind and my marriage was over. On the 6th of July, I asked for help and the doctors prescribed me 5 Valium tablets. 45 minutes after taking my first Valium ever, I wake up crying. It felt like someone opened the gateway to hell and said, here you are, deal with all your pain. I cried for 3 hours. Exhausted, I finally fell asleep at 3:30 a.m. on the 7th of July. I woke up at 9 a.m. with this overwhelming pain in my heart. Something was very wrong. Felt like my heart was going to break into a million pieces. At 11:59 a.m. I sent 5 messages saying, I am not okay. I never allowed anyone to see my vulnerability, my pain. So how could they know I really needed help? As my children said, if we knew how much pain you're in, Dad, we'd have been with you in a heartbeat. I'm grateful for my children, for the strength they showed through what must have been an awful time, seeing their father lose his mind and then project his anger. At my most painful moment, I could not show my pain or my vulnerability, so no one came. At 3:42 p.m. after an argument, I decided to take my own life. If it wasn't for my son's quick thinking, the police would never have found me. I would not be here today to share my story. In my experience, if your needs are not met, your development not provided, and you had some challenging experiences in any of your early developmental stages, then you will activate three of the greatest human fears. The fear that you're not lovable, that you're not good enough, and that you do not belong. I got all the human fears. I was not loved. I was not good enough, and I did not belong anywhere. I recreated the same belief as when I was 15 years old. The difference this time was, wasn't my father trying to kill me, it was me. Since 1996, I've been searching for that feeling when I was 5 years old. I've completed over 3,000 hours of therapy and personal development work so I could feel worthy, so I could feel that feeling I felt when I was 5 years old. Would you believe it was ineffective? The more work I completed, the more I couldn't handle my life until I admitted myself into a private psychiatric hospital for 3 weeks. This is where I leveraged my past learnings with the hospital expertise to finally complete my puzzle. I had to survive my world. I was so lonely, I built an armor so thick no one could penetrate it. My breakthrough came when I took the armor off, looked at my experiences, understood the meaning I gave them, looked at how they affected my life, radically accepted them, and allowed myself to feel my pain and to forgive. Forgive them and to forgive myself. I let no one see my demons, my pain, my fear, my shame, and the worthlessness I felt, how it has tormented me my whole life. I felt if you really knew who I was, you would all reject me. The only way I felt I could survive was to be strong, had to be the problem solver, the fixer of all things. That was all I knew until I lost everything. My executive role, my children's respect, my marriage, my self-respect, my mind, and what little dignity I had left. I searched for answers outside of myself and in others, but nothing I wanted was out there. I had to radically accept my truth. I hoped someone would come and save me from my hell, but no one came. All I wanted was someone to love me, to belong somewhere, have friends, and do normal stuff like play and have fun. You don't do over 3,000 hours of therapy and personal development work because you like it. I did it to find peace. I had to radically accept my truth, that both my parents tried to kill me. My mum abandoned me when I stood up for her. My sexuality was taken from me when I was 12. I was never invited to or attended one party, never had one friend. Had to care for my paranoid schizophrenic mum from ages 4 to 16, missing over 60% of my schooling. In my home, I saw things no child should have ever seen. It's not nice seeing your mum being raped. And to know that the world knew what was happening and they did nothing. The system knew and still they did nothing. When I completed my puzzle, something amazing happened. Someone did turn up for me. I turned up. I am responsible for my behaviour and my emotions. I learned that I must love myself first before anyone can love me. If I can heal, you can too, no matter what has happened to you. I realised that you cannot get rid of your experiences or your trauma. What you do is find the meaning you gave them. You neutralise them and turn them into your superpowers. I found my inner peace. By 16 kilos, my blood pressure has plummeted from 210 over 130 at its highest to no longer needing blood pressure medication. Who would have thought one act of kindness when I was 5 years old would change my life? If it wasn't for that one act of kindness, I would not have known what to look for. I would have given up a long time ago. I am worthy, I am lovable, and I do belong. My grandmother hurt my father, and my father hurt my mum and me. My great-grandfather and grandfather hurt my mum hurt me. My mum and dad hurt me, and I hurt my family and my children, and for that, I'm truly sorry. My message worth sharing is we should judge a little less and love a little more. Hurt people until you stop and love yourself first. Thank you. Oh,
If you would like to support the Her Story Circle so that we can curate more fascinating and intriguing stories around business and entrepreneurship, health and wellness, family and relationships, creativity, social justice, and spirituality, hit the donate button on the herstorycircle.com website, and this will help us reach more women and share these fascinating stories with you every single day. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you for listening in.
My name is Melissa Hopmeyer, and we are based out of Washington, D.C. in the USA.
I'm Catherine Marsh, and I am 44 years old. As you heard, we're based right outside of Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Her Story TV. This is Gertrude Matcha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. And as you know, I am bringing you some of the most fascinating women in the world coming from all four corners of the globe. We are graced with the presence of two amazing women today who are going to talk about a topic that is very, very close to my heart. Welcome, welcome, welcome to our circle. Please introduce yourselves, say your names, where you're based, how old you are, and share your story with us today.
Thank you so much for having us, Gertrude. My name is Melissa Hopmeyer, and we are based out of Washington, D.C. in the USA, and I'm 37 years old. And, you know, we host No Gray Zone podcast, as well as have a consulting business, Right Response Consulting. And Catherine and I are special victims prosecutors here in the U.S., and, you know, we have spent our careers fighting for victims of sexual abuse and domestic violence and child abuse. And when the pandemic struck, Catherine and I had a little more time on our hands than we normally do because we're normally in court so often. And we really thought about, you know, what could we do to prevent these crimes from happening? Because, you know, by the time we get and meet our victims, our survivors, the bad thing has already happened. And so many of them didn't know about resources or how crimes could be prevented because we don't really do a good job in the U.S. of educating our community about how to prevent these crimes. And so kind of I'll let Catherine finish up the story, but that is the beginning story of how No Gray Zone and Right Response created.
Wonderful.
And I'm Catherine Marsh, and I am 44 years old. As you heard, we're based right outside of Washington, D.C. And Melissa's right. We just wanted to find a way to share a lot of the resources and information that we know and individuals who work in gender-based violence and child abuse and sexual assault seem to know, but is so often not shared in the community. And I think one of the other things is Melissa and I are both moms. I have three young boys. Melissa has two girls. And when we would talk to our friends who are also parents, so often they'd say, you're talking to your kids about what? We don't talk about that yet. And we felt it was really important to share some of the information about why you need to talk to your children at a young age about consent. And consent doesn't have to be sexual, but just the fact that children as young as 2 and 3 have body autonomy and body rights as well. And how to talk to your children about body parts. And when they get older, about sexual relationships and healthy relationships and dating and all of those things that I think sometimes as adults, we start to take for granted and we forget how important that is to talk to our children when they are young.
Wow. So how do the two of you actually come together? Did you meet in the court system? It's very, very rare to find two individuals who have the same passion like you do. How did you find each other?
Catherine and I joke that we share the same brain sometimes. we met in the prosecutor's office. You know, Catherine came to work in the jurisdiction that I had been working in for a while. And I think we just connected over our passion for doing this work. I think people come and go as prosecutors, and there, you know, people will come into special victims to get some experience. And then there are people who it is their driving force to help survivors. And that's definitely Catherine, and I hope sometimes me too. I don't know if Catherine, you want to add anything about how we kind of came together.
No, I think that's it. I think I could say I knew Melissa was my partner in crime when the first thing she gave me was a pin that said "Believe Women." And I was like, that's it. That's it at its most basic. And again, we go with, we've broadened that now. We say it's not just women. It's believe survivors and start with belief in all things. Mm-hmm. And to be able to work with somebody day in and day out who has just that passion and that drive to make sure that we are always communicating with the people in our community and beyond, something as simple as start with belief, and just to be able to have somebody to bounce ideas off of every single day is my pleasure in working with Melissa.
That is absolutely wonderful. Now, we find ourselves in the middle of this pandemic right now, and domestic violence, sexual abuse has gone up globally. What can be done from your view in the world? I'm just going to open this up so we can have this conversation. We're reading in the papers the statistics of especially domestic violence going up because people are stuck in the home with partners, with husbands, and it's turning into another pandemic of its own, correct?
It absolutely is. You know, I say there's two things that I think every single person can do every single day to help end intimate partner violence, and that's educate and advocate. I think when we look at domestic violence, so for so many years, it was that happens in the home, and that's a family matter, and it's to stay behind closed doors. Yes. But what we know is that domestic violence impacts every single part of our society. You know, we know the statistics in the United States. We know that it's 12 million people every year in our country. We know that it's, Melissa, you can correct me, it's 20 people every minute who are victims of intimate partner violence. And we know that has a huge impact. They've done studies to find that days missed from work each year because of intimate partner violence is 36,000 jobs a year of just missed days. And so this isn't something that can stay behind closed doors, and it's not something that's a family matter. This impacts every single part of our society. And for me, Melissa is my person who has domestic violence inside out and backwards. And for me, I go with child abuse. And when I break down what the ACEs studies have shown for adverse childhood experiences and the stress that that puts on a body through a lifetime, and it impacts heart disease, cancer, diabetes, chances for stroke, all of those can be increased from children who witness domestic violence in the household. And so if we want a healthy society, if we want a society where everybody can work and everybody has a fair chance, then we can't get there if we are not addressing domestic violence.
I couldn't say it better myself. And on top of that, when children experience intimate partner violence in their home, it perpetuates and creates generational abuse, right? Children who witness domestic violence are more likely to be in relationships that are abusive and to be abusive in relationships. And so if, you know, we want to break that cycle and end intimate partner violence, we have to start now. We have to educate our community. We have to hold offenders accountable, and we have to educate our children.
Is that that saying that hurt people hurt people? It does become generational, and where does the cycle break? So what advice would you give to a woman who's listening to us right now, who's in her home, she can't leave, she can't go anywhere, probably doesn't have any money, doesn't have any emotional strength to do something. What are the first steps in a situation like that?
I would say make a plan. You know, it takes a while. It takes, I think, on average 7 times for a victim of domestic violence to finally leave. And that is usually when they've made a plan. And that can be, you know, squirreling away the smallest amount of money every week that you know is not going to be, you know, missed or accounted for. That could be getting copies made of your children's birth certificates or important medical documents. And the same thing for you. Create what we call a go bag, right? So put away a clean set of clothes for yourself, for any kids, all of your important documents in there, any money you're able to save. And then when you're safe and you've created that plan where you know, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to go to this hotel. I have enough money to stay there for a week. And then I'm going to, you know, call my family and I'm going to change my phone number. And I'm going to, when you're ready, you just get that bag and you leave everything else behind and you go and you just don't look back. Don't answer the phone when he calls. You know, I recommend change your phone number, go somewhere where he or she doesn't know where you're going to be. You know, a lot of people will say, I'm going to go stay with my family, but unfortunately, you know, these abusers know family. So I always tell them, you need to go somewhere that you're going to be safe, that they're not going to come looking for you, because they will come looking for you. And you know, once you have a plan in place of how long you can afford to stay in a place, you know, I know we've helped victims, you know, gather enough money to make a down payment for a new apartment in a new city.
Oh, wow.
And months and months and months until they squirreled together enough money to put that down payment then. And then they just went, you know, once they were able to make that plan, they went, and they had to, you know, you have to kind of start a new life. But, that I think is my advice, is to just start small, start making a plan, get that bag together. And then when you're ready, leave and just don't look back. And I know it's hard. You know, so many women have, you know, they don't have financial power because that's taken from them. They don't have emotional strength because that is, you know, either physically or emotionally beaten out of them. But they should know that there are people here who can help them and that, you know, they are strong enough to do it.
And I think that's what Melissa just ended with is also important. Don't be afraid to ask for help. I think so often survivors, because of the trap nature of being in the home or the power and control dynamic, don't understand how many resources are available to help, or because of how they've been treated or they've been told nobody cares or nobody would believe you, that they start to think that. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important to know you can and you should ask for help, and to understand that there's no shame in where you are. That there's no shame in the fact that you have been in an abusive relationship. I think the one thing that we have seen throughout the world is that anybody can end up in an abusive relationship, from somebody who is homeless to the most powerful women in the world. We have seen in abusive relationships. So don't take shame onto yourself. Don't take guilt onto yourself. Be willing and able to ask for help, and then make that plan to get out. Because there will be people, this network of women that you make with Her Story, there's a network of women, there's a network of services who just want to help other women get out and be safe.
That is awesome. That is just absolutely awesome. So I'm going to ask you guys a really funny little question, and it's going to lead into 2 or 3 questions. If time was an illusion, and your past, your present, your future existed in the same timeline, and you could go back to your younger selves and have a conversation with that young woman who decided to go down this career path, based on what life has taught you, what would you say to her? There's a lot of young girls looking for careers, unsure of what to do. You seem to have found a vocation that sounds to me like it's your life purpose. It's your reason for being. What would you say to her?
Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Really, I think I look back when I was younger and how much I felt I had to do this. I had to do this, or I was afraid to try and experiment down a path that it micro. That's what growing up is for, right? That's what for, you know, high school and college, that those age brackets up until our 20s is for. Figure out what your passion is. Don't be afraid to make that mistake. Don't be afraid to try something and fail. You yeah. know, I mean, I have said, and I know Melissa feels the same, I have learned the most from every single failure I have made. When I try something the first time and it works, I don't learn that much from it. It just worked out well, you know? So put yourself out there, make the mistake. Don't be afraid to fail, and don't be so hard on yourself. I think we are always our own worst critics, and it's so easy to say because I'm still my own worst critic, but don't be so hard on yourself.
Don't be so hard on yourself is definitely number one for me. And then I think the other thing I would say to my younger self is don't be afraid to take up space. I think as women, we don't take up enough space in the conversation, in the room, in life. You know, we always want to make sure that other people are served first and that other people's needs are taken care of. And we feel like we have, you know, this level of imposter syndrome that we don't belong in the room when we do belong in the room. And we do have, you know, good ideas, and we deserve to be put first sometimes. And I think that it took me a lot of years. I probably still don't learn that lesson completely, Catherine would say, to know that, you know, I'm enough and that I'm good enough to be in the room and that my voice and my opinions matter. And so I think that's probably what I would tell myself is, you know, don't be afraid to use your voice and to take up room.
That is absolutely awesome. So now let's teleport you into the future. And you're going to have a conversation with the 100-year-old you sitting in a rocking chair, reflecting back on your life. If you could have a conversation with the future you, what would you say to her based on what you're doing with your life right now?
I think I would say that I hope that I made a difference. That I hope that that what I did wasn't just for money or, you know, fame or fortune. Not that any of those things have come to me, but that what the work that I did really made an impact on someone's life. And that people's lives were better because of the work that I did. And I think that that's the most important thing that you can leave as a legacy, is that people, when they think of you, they think that person is willing to help, or that person helped. And that's what I would ask myself is, did you leave your mark and did you help?
Wonderful.
I can't top that, you know. It's I sit here and I go with, you know, it's like Melissa said, but anytime I went camping with my dad when I was younger, his thing was, you always leave the place looking better than when you got here, right? It's always better when you leave. And I think that's the ultimate goal, is that I'm 100 and I look back and I say, you know what? I made my community better than it was before I started. And if I can say that at 100, then you know what? Life's complete. And I can say, good job. You led a great life. And that's the ultimate goal, right?
That is the ultimate goal. That is absolutely wonderful. And you know, for me, coming from Africa, every time I go back to my village, to my community, I've just come to realize that I just have to keep showing up as me. You know, sometimes these young little girls need to see the role models of what they can be themselves. When I created my tourism business, I started driving the truck with all these tourists to the village. And I remember I was at the school where I support 350 kids. And there were two little six-year-olds, and they were following me around the whole day. And I stopped to hear what they were saying. And one of them said, "Oh my gosh, she's so beautiful." And then the other one said, "And she's driving the car." And I just marveled at the fact that I had shown up as the strong woman who can actually drive a vehicle, because women don't drive cars in my community. And even if I did nothing else for these children and I just kept showing up, my job was done. So as women, we are the role models for the future generation. And it really excites me to rub shoulders with women like you who are out there using the law, empowering women so they know their rights, they know where to find help. Thank you so much for what you're doing. And it's one woman at a time. For me, it's one story at a time. And I hope that there's somebody who's listening to this interview who is in the middle of the fog, and this interview has become the light at the end of your tunnel. Don't give up. The support is there. I'll be sharing all of the contact details with these two amazing women so you can get in touch and be supported and be inspired. So thank you, ladies, for gracing me with your presence today. It just lifts me up and make me do what I do every single day to connect women to each other, to connect those who don't have the resources so they can find them. And thank you to everybody who's tuned in. Come back again tomorrow. I'll be interviewing yet another amazing woman from a different part of the world. The Her Story Circle is about empowerment. It's about collaboration. It's about empathy. It's about compassion. And we're here to make a difference in each other's lives and to lift each other up. So thank you, thank you, thank you, ladies. See you tomorrow, everybody. Bye for now.
Her Story Circle is a social impact project focused primarily on women and children around the globe. We raise money by curating all of these amazing stories into a series of books, an anthology series where we publish 10 stories in every volume. So you can support us by buying the books. You can support us by donating towards this podcast. You can support us by sponsoring some of the social impact projects that we have highlighted on our website. The link to all our projects is theherstorycircle.com/projects. Our projects range from business initiatives where we set up women's cooperatives and help women get out of poverty. We help people who are helping in their communities. It could be that woman who started a soup kitchen and is helping feed the homeless because of the COVID pandemic. We support women who are focused around the elderly, the homeless, and the disabled. So feel free to go onto the herstorycircle.com website, go into our project section, and see what could inspire you to be part of our circle. Thank you so much. Looking forward to connecting with you. A special thanks goes to our main sponsor, SkinnyTees.com, based in Detroit, Michigan. Linda Schlesinger Wagner is an amazing woman who shared a story of how she created this amazing business at the age of 63. When she heard the vision behind the Her Story Circle, she became our main sponsor, and I would love you to go onto her website, check out her amazing t-shirts that suit every woman, every age, every size. The website is skinnytees.com. Please support this amazing sponsor who is helping us bring these fascinating stories to you every single day. Thank you, Linda.
My name is Joanne Moore. I am 64 years old.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Her Story TV and the Her Story podcast.
This is Gertrude Macha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. And I am graced with the presence of yet another creative woman coming to us all the way from the United States. Welcome to our tribe. Tell everybody your full name, where you're based, how old you are, and share your story with us today.
Well, first of all, it is an honor to meet you and speak with you. I do feel like I'm on your sofa in your living room. But my name is Joanne Moore. I am 64 years old, young. I feel young. I am based in the mountains in Colorado, but luckily for me, I get to travel throughout the United States and sometimes out of the country. And I do luxury weddings everywhere I go, and I bring that happily ever after to the couples. But my story started out as a normal little girl growing up in the United States. I'm one of five children, and I didn't realize that my family had what I call untruths until I became a teenager. And my oldest brother, listening to my parents talking to him about college and what do you want to do when you leave, and what do you want to be when you grow up, and them offering to pay for his college. And he went into law enforcement, got into the police academy. But then years later, it was my turn. And I kept waiting for that conversation. I was so excited to tell them, I know what I want to do. I want to go in the medical field. I want to work and help people and save lives. And that conversation never came. And I remember watching my parents sitting in the living room talking, and I announced myself and asked to speak with them about what I wanted to do when I left high school in just a few months. And my dad looked at me stunned. He got up and left the room. And my mother at that point, as I continued to say, Mom, I need some help. I don't know what to do. Remember, this is before computers and this is before the internet. So we had yellow pages. We had no Google. And my mother then told me that that's not what we do. Those are the five words. That's not what we do. And I was stunned. I'd never heard that from her. I mean, I was a little girl that danced and did gymnastics, and I even twirled a baton. I could not understand why all of a sudden there's barriers for me. And it was with that I had to learn how to do these things on my own. I had no help whatsoever to figure out what my journey and my path for me to fulfill what my dreams were for me. It was okay to do that for my brothers, but it wasn't okay for me. I had learned that the journey from the generations before me had to be mine, that women were expected right out of high school, if we chose to graduate high school, we were to soon after get married and start a family and stay home and take care of the house, the husband, and the children. And although I wanted those things, I wanted more. And it was an incredibly uphill battle for me and my journey to disclose what the untruth was in my family.
Wow, what a journey you've been on. But it sounds to me like you managed to turn that around, created an incredible, incredible life, an incredible business, mother of five. You know, I kind of cyberstalked you when I got the application that you'd be on the show. How did that all come to being? You defied all the odds of what life had prepared you for. How was that possible?
It is a strong will that came from the gut. I can't even explain it. I knew there was more for me in my life, that although I wanted these things, I wanted more. I wanted to contribute. And it was in speaking with people and learning, I knew I needed three things. I needed a car. I needed a job. And I needed an education outside of high school. And even my guidance counselor at my high school sided with my parents and said, well, you know, your parents don't want that for you, so good luck. And so it was my struggle that I did find a way to buy a car. I did find a job. I started out making $1.35 at one of those big box, you know, department stores. And I found that there was a vocational school just a couple of blocks away from where I was working. I immediately interviewed with them. They had a course on respiratory therapy. I had no idea that was even something, and learned all about it, got everything I could, talked to the professors, toured the facility, signed up. 2 weeks before I graduated, I announced to my parents what I was going to do. And that was a very sad time for me, that here I was getting ready to graduate high school and my parents were angry with me. They wouldn't go to my graduation. They were punishing me for not following what the family tradition was, that women, these are our roles, stay in your lane, don't cause trouble. And I couldn't do that. So I went on and went to school, graduated in less than a year. I was determined that no one was going to stop me. I was 19 years old when I started working in the hospital. Several years later, to get to an incredible turning point for me, several years later, I get a call from my mom that my dad is very, very sick and that he wants to come see me. And I'm at a hospital that he has no business being at. And I encouraged him to go to a different hospital. Here's the doctor. Go see this doctor. And my 2 hours later, my dad shows up at the hospital I'm working at. And he has all kinds of issues with high blood pressure. His pulse is going off the charts. It was like 240 over 140 blood pressure. And I did an EKG on him because that's my job. I was working in cardiopulmonary at this particular hospital, which is heart and lung. And I saw he's having arrhythmias. And I told him, I said, Dad, you're going to have a stroke right here. Let me get you an ambulance and get you to the hospital I told you to go to. And he was defiant, drove himself. He was in intensive care, cardiac intensive care for over 2 weeks. When I finally got to see him a few weeks later, I asked him, why on earth did you wait so long to get medical help? He disclosed his family untruth that floored me. He said that since he was a little boy, he was told that all the men in his family pass away by the age of 45. He was 48 years old and thought he cheated death 3 extra years. He accepted that untruth. So what I fought so hard to do, working cardiopulmonary, heart and lung, ended up saving his life by making him get help. And maybe that was the drive and the determination that I was supposed to have, was to save my father's life. He passed 10 years later, but he had all this other time to enjoy his family and his children. And he woke up to the fact that, well, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea to let her go to school and do what she wanted to do. Yes, that's
what a beautiful story.
Yeah, it was, but it was like nothing I could explain. It was a drive like I've never had before. Mm-hmm. And then years later, I moved out of state into the beautiful area of Vail, Colorado, and they didn't have my job available. And I was okay with that. And so I learned how to become a wedding planner, which was my second passion. And I never looked back. And now that's my journey.
So tell us about your luxury weddings. What do you offer? I am such a diehard romantic. I just love weddings. Oh. What does your service offer?
Well, I too love weddings, and I got into it quite by accident, because in small communities and small towns, you are required to help out with community events. So I started volunteering with festivals and parades and music things and, you know, art festival, all those kinds of things. And I loved it. And someone asked me to help plan their wedding because they have no idea, and they love my organizational skills and they love my creativity. And I was so flattered that someone noticed that about me. And I said, absolutely, I'm in for a challenge. And I planned their wedding. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We had fish bowls with fish. They were kayakers, so they got married under two kayaks. And I'm like, I can do this. And so I remember going home and telling my husband, I said, I want to do this. I want to make a career out of this. And this is, my husband's an amazing man, and he never tells me no. And he says, well, I think you need to get the education that you need to be successful. Yeah. And again, still no internet. So we searched and found a class that I could take. And that's how I got started. And I learned everything I needed to learn to start a business. My first year, I opened my sign, put my sign out, open for business. I booked 30 weddings that first year.
Are you serious?
It was a need. It was a need in the community I lived in. And I knew the community well, and everyone knew me for my abilities, and they all recommended me without advertising. 30 weddings my first year was too many. I cried a lot, but but it was a wonderful transition. Like, oh my goodness, I can do this. And I never looked back. I am blessed with working with the most amazing couples, with their love stories and their journey and their inspirations for wanting to bring their love and show it off to the world, to their family and friends. It's just a remarkable career.
So how has the current situation in the world impacted your business? You know, COVID-19 has had a lot of entrepreneurs have to pivot and be really creative. What is the situation in the US? Are people still able to have their weddings? Let's go into that a little bit.
Well, it's different everywhere. In the U.S., every community, every town, every city, every state has different rules and regulations. And for me to be able to travel from one state to the other, I really have to dig deep and find out what I'm allowed and are not allowed to do. What I can do in Colorado, and as I said, I was just in Florida, it's completely different in the state of Florida. So, but with that, I make sure that my team and, you know, the caterers and the photographers and the florists and everyone is protected with the mask and everything. So yes. I have the high regulations for them. And the guests are asked to follow the curriculum, if you will, for the day, mm-hmm. but that's not always the case. A little couple of drinks here and there, but it is coming back, and my phone is literally ringing off the hook that those mm-hmm. that postponed their wedding are now mm-hmm. wanting to rebook, and those that just got engaged during the pandemic, what a story their grandchildren are going to hear someday, are now planning their wedding. So we are colliding with weddings, so everything's getting booked up really quick. But again, we've still got some, but we're hopeful. We are very hopeful, even with the restrictions we still have in place.
Oh, that is amazing. So if you could have a conversation with the older you, let's just imagine that time is an illusion, your past, your present exist in the same timeline. And you could have a conversation with you at the age of 100. And you're sitting with your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, your dogs, your cats, reflecting back on your life. What would you say to that amazing woman who has done all of these things?
Wow. I think I would tell them we all have our own journey. Don't let the outside voices tell you different. Listen to your heart. Listen to your gut. You know where you need to go. You know you can do it. And you can do it. And then I would say, don't just reach for the stars. Be one. That's what I would tell them.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely beautiful. Well, it has been fantastic connecting with you. Thank you so much for what you do for the world of love. We do need more love in this world.
We do.
And it's the people who facilitate to bring that joy in families that really makes a difference.
I agree. And thank you for what you do, my dear. You are a special person, and I appreciate you and your time.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to everybody who's tuned in. I told you we have some amazing women who are just movers and shakers in this world. They bring about joy, they bring love, and they're changing lives one woman at a time, one story at a time. So this is Gertrude Macha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. I'll be back again tomorrow with yet another amazing guest. Have a fantastic day wherever you are in the world. Bye for now. Thank you.
If you like this podcast and would like to understand a little bit more about what was discussed, then you are in luck. Simply head over to the herstorycircle.com where we have a fantastic bonus gift waiting for you to download. All we ask is that you leave a raving review. And lastly, help us share this podcast with your friends, your family, and your colleagues through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and all your social media platforms. We really appreciate your support and look forward to seeing you again in our next episode. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode of the Her Story Circle. Once again, to get access to all the replays and future episodes, visit theherstorycircle.com and subscribe today.